When Netflix first began acquiring original movies, it sent a ripple of concern through film circles. Wouldn't the streaming giant simply take opportunities away from less mainstream, more experimental filmmakers? But some of its recent releases have suggested it's a more cinema-literate operation than we may have previously thought. Hi, I'm Nathan Weinbender, and on this week's episode of Movies 101, Dan Webster, Mary Pat Truthart, and I will discuss two unusual new films, well, maybe not totally new, that we saw courtesy of Netflix. The Other Side of the Wind is a long unfinished 1970s Orson Welles film that has just recently been reconstructed, and Shirkers is a documentary about another unfinished film and the man who both drove the project forward and eventually undid it. So don't touch that dial, because a binge-worthy Movies 101 is returning in just a moment right here on Spokane Public Radio.
Hi, I'm Rick Steves. Your membership pledge to Spokane Public Radio is a tangible demonstration of your commitment to this radio station. It keeps this service alive, vital, and growing, a benefit to the entire community. Thank you so much for contributing to Spokane Public Radio. The value of public radio in our communities has never been greater, and you are a vital part of the equation.
Hi, I'm Nathan Weinbender, film critic for Spokane Public Radio and film and music editor for The Inlander.
And I'm Mary Pat Truthart, part-time film critic, full-time law professor at Gonzaga University School of Law.
And I'm Dan Webster, also a film critic for Spokane Public Radio and blogger for Spokane7.com.
And welcome to Movies 101, the show that will check out new cinema anywhere, even if it's not in a cinema. We know that theaters are filled with prestige films and Oscar hopefuls, but two of the most interesting and challenging movies of the year are available to watch right now for anyone with a Netflix subscription. On this week's show, we'll be discussing the strange circumstances surrounding two films that were left unfinished for years, and which are finally, in one form or another, seeing the light of day via the streaming service. The first is the swan song of a towering figure in cinema, Orson Welles, whose showbiz satire The Other Side of the Wind remained incomplete for 40 years, until recently. The next unfinished film was made by teenagers in 1990s Singapore, a weird cross-country crime film that was shot and then went missing. It was called Shirkers, which is also the title of the new documentary about its unusual origins. But first, let's talk about one of the greatest of all film directors. Orson Welles' career is the stuff of showbiz tragedy. At 25, he had complete artistic freedom when he debuted with 1941's Citizen Kane. Maybe you've heard of it. But just about every film that followed was either heavily compromised by studios or left unfinished. One of those long-discussed but little-seen projects was The Other Side of the Wind, which was shot in piecemeal fashion between 1970 and 1976 and remained unfinished during Welles' lifetime, primarily due to, but certainly not limited to, his inability to scrape together funds. But now, using Welles' work print and notes as a guide, historians have finally assembled a version of Wind that most likely matches Welles' original vision, and what we get turns out to be a wild stylistic departure from anything that Welles, or for that matter, most other old Hollywood filmmakers, had done up to that point. So now that it's available, what's it about? See if any of this sounds familiar. The Other Side of the Wind stars John Huston as a cantankerous veteran director, making a film that's a wild stylistic departure from anything he's done before, but he's having a hard time scraping together funds. At a party celebrating his 70th birthday, the director, named Jake Hannaford, is surrounded by acolytes, critics, admirers, enablers, and sycophants, many of whom are wielding handheld cameras, the footage from which ostensibly makes up this film. Interjected with this jittery, chaotic footage are scenes from Hannaford's in-progress picture, also called The Other Side of the Wind, an erotic, vividly colored parody of 1970s European cinema starring Welles' own mistress, Oya Kodar. In between all this is the strange father-son dynamic between Hannaford and the protege, whose career has eclipsed his own. The younger man is played by Peter Bogdanovich, himself a wildly successful Welles protege, whose relationship with Welles was, at the time of filming, on the rocks. This is all very much of its time, and it's all very meta, before that term even existed, but is The Other Side of the Wind anything more than a curiosity for film buffs? Will anyone outside of, basically, the people in this room care about this movie?
That is, of course, the question, and I think that I'm somewhat qualified to answer that because right around the time that this film began production in 1970, was right around the time that I had just gotten out of the Army. I went back to school and I started seeing movies just whenever I could and every movie that I could. And I immersed myself in films of the 70s and late 60s. And a lot of those movies were very much like what we see on the screen. A lot of them were experimental. They had no plot. They seemed thrown together, but there was a feeling about them. There was a vitality to them that spoke to those of us then that don't necessarily speak to anybody now. And I think that if The Other Side of the Wind, the way it is constructed with the movie within a movie, if it were done by any other filmmaker, people would justifiably classify it as, well, that was interesting bit of junk. But it was made by Orson Welles, and therefore it's a curiosity. It has to remain a curiosity because this is one of the greatest filmmakers of all time. And it is his own story writ large on the screen. So you can't just dismiss it. But that is a far cry from saying this is a good movie.
And I agree. And I think part of the difficulty is we have this project that was troubled over the course of 15 years. And then different people tried to step in, including Peter Bogdanovich, including John Huston, including some of the camera people who were involved, and were all taking these different efforts to finish it. It got tied up in litigation.
Involving the Shah of Iran at one
point. It was completely bizarre. So that backstory, and we'll talk a little bit about the fact there is a documentary about this film. Obviously, we don't know what we would have gotten, but it seems as though there's this bizarre movie within the movie that is this haunting portrayal of nothingness. And so I like that. There's these scenes and there's not really a plot and a doll shows up and so forth. But
the midgets with the fireworks.
And they're like mannequins all over the place.
Right. Yeah. But that wasn't necessarily in the movie within a movie. The regular movie. And
the
so I think part of the difficulty was, I had read that Orson Welles hated Antonioni. And so that he was mocking in this very sort of heavy-handed way some of these artistes, these cineasts. So he was just making fun of everyone. And so I don't think that the film comes off as wicked or sardonic enough because it has these two things going on at the same time because other people finished it. But it really does skewer some of the greats, the icons of film from various continents, as a matter of fact. As we were watching this, as it went on, Dan said, I'm liking this better and better and better as
grew
time
on
goes
me.
On.
I mean, the first half hour, I thought, this is horrible. But as it went on, I went, but it's horribly intriguing.
Yeah.
I can't stop watching
it. Well, the thing about The Other Side of the Wind is you sort of have to approach it in two ways. It's inextricably linked to its own history, and therefore it is somewhat about its own making.
Right.
Whether Orson Welles ever intended that.
Right.
And so it does have this kind of Hall of Mirrors quality, which of course is recalling the famous sequence from The Lady from Shanghai, another Orson Welles film, or even something like F for Fake, which is this really strange kind of pseudo-documentary that he made near the end of his career that is one of my favorite Welles films. I mean,
I liked that a lot
too.
It's
so curious. Yeah. And this movie has a lot of those qualities. But then you also have to look at it as a product of the time in which it was pieced together. Because it is funny to me that Welles decided, he goes, okay, I'm going to skewer the hip new type of filmmaking. And the hip new type of filmmaking at the time was something that so completely outrageous now. Like, if you go back and watch some of those Antonioni films, and I'm a big Antonioni fan, they're so unusual and completely unlike anything you've seen before, and yet they were like the most popular thing going. So that kind of breaks your brain a little bit, because that kind of filmmaking just isn't popular at all and probably never will be again. So I find it really interesting as both kind of like a museum piece, but also really invigorating as a film, because the way that it's been put together, and of course there's an argument about whether we can even call this an Orson Welles film because he's been dead for so long. There's an energy to this movie, this kind of chaos that is going on, because it is coming from all these different sources. I mean, the concept that the footage we're seeing within the party is being shot by the people in the party, which of course isn't totally true.
No.
But I mean, that is reflected in just kind of this jittery, jumpy quality. And so the movie does kind of put you off right away because, like, I've never seen a movie that's been constructed and edited and made this way. It's so unusual. I mean, I guess it's weirdly of its time and ahead of its time at the same time.
And I think that is the one thing that some people might appreciate about The Other Side of the Wind. So those of us who came of age during the 1970s, you can see some of the ridiculousness and the sort of pomposity involved with that era. But then there's also this sort of sincerity and authenticity and mm-hmm. this yearning and so forth.
And it's and beauty, too.
Yeah. And I thought that was captured in a very intriguing sort of way. We also know, as I mentioned, that there was a documentary made about the making of this film.
Yeah, and it's on Netflix right now. It's called They'll Love Me When I'm Dead, made mm-hmm. by Morgan Neville, who just recently did Won't You Be My Neighbor, the Mr. Rogers documentary. And They'll Love Me When I'm Dead, I think it's necessary viewing, whether you want to watch it
before or after.
I watched it after. It's put together in a sort of elliptical, mysterious fashion, not unlike one of Welles' own late period movies, which might frustrate some people because it's like, can you just tell me the straightforward history of this movie? But there's no way to tell a straightforward history of this movie mm-hmm. because it is so peculiar. And Welles' own career, they talk about this in the Neville film. They talk about how he was adamant that The Other Side of the Wind was not autobiographical. And of course, that's a total lie because of course it is.
Yeah.
The real world parallels in this film, I mean, even just the casting of Peter Bogdanovich, who weirdly enough replaced Rich Little. Rich Little was the original actor and shot months and months of footage.
You see him in one short scene.
Yeah.
I turned to Mary Pat and went, that's Rich Little.
Yeah, he was originally the Peter Bogdanovich character and was tied up in this production.
No, that would not have worked. So I'm glad that they pulled the plug on that.
And Peter Bogdanovich, his original role was like as a Jerry Lewis kind of...
He's like a paparazzi kind of guy,
exactly.
A celebrity journalist. And so just the way that this movie, I mean, it changed so much over the course of its making, and I think that's reflected in the movie.
Yeah.
And it is funny because he's making fun of, as you said, Mary Pat, the pomposity of 1970s European cinema. But the film itself, The Other Side of the Wind, not the movie within the movie, but the movie proper, certainly has a pomposity to it. You're talking about Orson Welles, one of the most pompous figures in all of Hollywood. So,
it's a
snake eating its own tail, this movie.
It's a movie of its time that can't be divorced from that time.
No.
We can look back on it now, because it fits in so many genres, the movie within the movie about the making of movies, the mm-hmm. movie, Hollywood has done that to death. I think it is a film for cineasts. Maybe we're the only ones who would really, truly appreciate it.
I can't imagine if you don't have even a cursory knowledge of Welles and his career, if this would work, but
or
maybe
European
it would, I don't know.
Cinema.
Yeah, that
who,
too.
Who is Michelangelo Antonioni? Who is Federico Fellini?
Yeah, right. But
for that matter, who's Robert Altman? So,
but who's Orson Welles?
That's right.
Or John Huston or Peter Bogdanovich?
Yeah.
But I love that era of film, and so I kind of loved this. It's not a movie in the traditional sense of the word, but what a fascinating
thing it is. Paired with the documentary?
Yeah, a great history lesson for you. And that was The Other Side of the Wind. And with that, it's time for us to look toward the other side of the break. See what I did there?
Mm-hmm.
Before we go, though, let me remind you that you can hear the weekly reviews Dan and I write at SpokanePublicRadio.org. When we return, we'll look at Shirkers. You're listening to Spokane Public Radio. And we're back. This is Movies 101, and I'm your host, Nathan Weinbender. During the first half of this Netflix-centric show, Mary Pat Truthart, Dan Webster, and I discussed Orson Welles' long-lost film, The Other Side of the Wind. Now let's turn our attention to another long-lost film from a totally different time and place, this one the subject of a great new documentary. In the early 1990s, teenager Sandy Tan and her friends, obsessed with David Lynch and the French New Wave, decided they wanted to make a feature film of their own. So Tan wrote a screenplay called Shirkers, a surreal picaresque about a teenage serial killer who may also be some kind of angel of death, and they managed to convince some folks with money to give them funding and a little film stock. Tan herself took on the central role, her friends stepped in as producers, and the whole thing was shot guerrilla style, their film teacher George Cardona serving as the director. Oh, and this all happened in Singapore, which had only recently shed an authoritarian government and didn't have a film industry to speak of. Oh, and that film teacher slash director eventually took all the film negatives and vanished without any explanation. Tan, who has also worked as a successful film critic and novelist, has now directed a documentary, also called Shirkers, about the experience of making this movie, and about her quest to track down George and those missing film canisters. From the outset, we know at least some of the footage from Shirkers survived, because it's intercut throughout Tan's documentary, and what we see is simply remarkable. Colorful, strange, visually playful, and eerily prescient of the indie boom of the late 1990s. But I'm not going to spill any more details about this wonderful movie, which is endlessly fascinating, a self-reflexive examination of our drive to create, an intriguing mystery about a mad wannabe Svengali, and an ultimately inspirational tribute to the fierce ingenuity of independent filmmakers.
So you said you weren't going to spill any more of the details, so does that fall on me to determine should be shared and what should not?
It's a free country. You can do whatever you want.
The butler did it. Everybody knows.
So to talk around this movie, because there are things that maybe we don't want to reveal completely, I was fascinated throughout, and the visual imagery, as you indicated, Nathan, is amazing. But the thing that I liked the best about the film is the fact that these three young women made this film together and played different roles at a time, you know, when they weren't really, they were aspiring film students. And
they were barely teenagers. Right, they were 16 years old,
right,
Sandy
and
Tan
the fact
was.
That they were able to come up with this vision and more important, collaborate effectively with one another to pull this thing off is mind-boggling.
Yeah.
And then, of course, it takes a turn because this person in whom they had placed all this trust and confidence, who they viewed as a mentor, does them wrong. And so then they have to deal with that sort of
And they
of
have no
fallout.
Idea why. They don't
right.
understand.
They
yeah.
have no sense of that. And even now, we don't really or completely have a sense of why George, who was
Cardona.
Their film instructor, who they viewed as not necessarily a colleague, but certainly viewed as somebody that they aspired to be like, who seemed to support them, who seemed to have this great relationship with people in their age cohort, they're just mystified by what happened. And it also had a huge impact on their relationship, their friendship among the three of them. And what I liked the best about Shirkers, honestly, was she has the opportunity. So Sandy Tan has the opportunity to interview her two friends. And they've had some sporadic contact with one another over the years. But I thought that they did a really nice job of doing this soul searching, of speaking frankly about what had transpired, looking at their own careers, because one's an academic. Sandy Tan, as you pointed out, is a filmmaker and a novelist. Her friend had been a successful filmmaker.
Yeah.
So I thought that was a really intriguing aspect of how you use this found footage, how you tell the story, and how you bring in current events to this whole endeavor and tell a history about Singapore, tell a history mm-hmm. about the film scene in Singapore, tell a history about film criticism in Singapore. Mm-hmm. So I really enjoyed this.
Yeah, you know, I mean, there's so many ways to describe Shirkers. If you look at it just straight on, you think, actually, there's really kind of a thin story for a documentary here because basically these kids, they made a film and somebody took it. And then what happened? I think to a certain extent, these girls had a sensibility. But from what I was able to see of the film they did, it was basically a beginner's film done by kids.
It's a road movie. Yeah.
But seriously, I think that we can overstate the importance of what they finally did. To me, the heart of the film is Sandy Tan herself, because Sandy Tan, it was the betrayal that she felt after spending time with George Cardona, having her heart broken by having basically her youth taken away from her. The whole movie, to me, is a look back at her past, at the nostalgia of her past, at, as you pointed out, Mary Pat, her making up and breaking up with her friends, but just trying to put at rest all these years of hurt and loss. And in that sense, I found Shirkers an incredibly moving film.
Well, it's interesting because I said this is a road movie and there is a road movie component to it, but the film Shirkers itself
yes.
was a teenage road movie because they're
yeah.
walking
yes.
around
right.
Singapore.
Yes. Right.
And the thing that was intriguing, Nathan, as you alluded to, is the fact that we saw old Singapore. I mean, we saw what it used to look like.
Right.
And now we're accustomed to seeing crazy rich Asians, and it's a completely different landscape.
Yep.
And so this was sort of a weird capture of that time period that's probably never going to be shown in the same way because there weren't films during that time
and
period.
And so this narrative film becomes itself something of an unintentional documentary because they're using people that they're just finding on the street. They actually track down a couple of the actors who were like, oh, I showed up to this audition and
the
I didn't really know what it was.
Yeah,
and then I never saw it. You talked, Dan, about the footage of the film itself that we see in Shirkers calling it a beginner's film. I'm going to push back against that because what struck me most about this, and I'm a sucker for a here's how we made this movie documentary. I just kind of love that genre, and there are some great ones out there, and I think this is one of them. The footage that we see, what struck me was how completely unusual it was. I mean, the colors of the film, the way that they framed things, it has an almost haunting quality to it. And the audio mix is missing. So it's all silent footage. And so it adds kind of this
eeriness
quality. To it.
And,
yeah.
and it's also focused on children. And so we see
in roles that children shouldn't be playing.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, it does feel like a Bugsy Malone kind of kids in adult dress-up. But that kind of adds to the charm of it. And then they talk near the end of Shirkers about how all of these indie films from the late 90s, early 2000s, they're talking about Wes Anderson and Terry Zwigoff. The visual language of those filmmakers is sort of echoed in Shirkers. I mean, it's totally unintentional, obviously. And
done much better.
Well, sure, done much better. I mean, it wasn't done by a bunch of children in Singapore. But considering that it was a bunch of children in Singapore, I think the footage is remarkable.
But also, let's remember that George Cardona was 40 years old, and he directed this
film.
Right,
right. And so, I'm sure his guiding hand helped. And he knew that, which is possibly why he ended up fleeing with the footage in the first place.
And the thing is, we do expect that this film is going to go in one direction, maybe, that there's going to be a creepiness factor that never really
appears. It's there from the beginning.
Right.
Yeah.
But I think this film should be really inspirational for teens who are doing their own video blogs and so forth and so on, because these young women were involved in creating this newspaper and doing all this other like sort of PR and media stuff of the time. And I thought that that was really creative and inspiring and fun. And so I would say, know what you're getting into, but I would definitely tell people to watch this movie, especially if you have teenage girls.
That's what both these movies have in common. They're basically films about the making of films. And anybody who's interested in film, I think, can learn something by watching either The Other Side of the Wind or Shirkers.
And not only that, but they're about films that had to be pieced together because elements, for whatever reason, were lost to time, and they will never be completed as they were originally intended by the artist. That window has passed. So it's also sort of about the fragility of film itself. The fact that even though
films exist at all,
but the fact that you might have a hard copy of something, even the negatives of the film, doesn't mean that that film can ever happen. And so there is this almost ethereal quality to just the story behind Shirkers. Like Other Side of the Wind, this is on Netflix right now. You can watch it if you have a Netflix subscription. I love this movie. This is like top 10 of the year material for me.
I really just think it's
stunning. So please check it out. Dan, I don't know why you're laughing. This is a great choice for a top 10 list.
You're channeling your own 16-year-old self.
Well, yeah, what's wrong with that?
Isn't that what
this movie taps into?
Yeah,
I
think
I'm young at heart, unlike some people in this room. And that was Shirkers, and this has been Movies 101, where earlier in the show, Dan Webster, Mary Pat Truthart, and I discussed The Other Side of the Wind. As is the case every week, I'd like to thank Jim Tevenin, who produces and engineers the show, and you, our loyal listeners, for tuning in. We'll be back next week, same time and channel, and we'll again take a deep dive into the world of contemporary cinema. Until then, let me leave you with a quote from the incomparable Orson Welles. A film is never really good unless the camera is an eye in the head of a poet. You're listening to Spokane Public Radio.
The Movies 101 podcast is made possible by the members of Spokane Public Radio. Become a member at SpokanePublicRadio.org. Thanks for listening to Movies 101.